Okay, so today we come to finally the last chapter of Leviticus. I'm actually going to do a couple more classes to wrap things up by tying some things in with the New Testament and maybe answering a repeated request in regard to the various meals of the Old Covenant. So we're not going to finish with Leviticus yet with our study, but we are coming to the end of the book today as we look at Leviticus chapter 27. We have mentioned this chapter a little bit before when we were talking about the trespass offering and how it desanctified things, and we had a little discussion there about Jephthah's daughter and so forth. But now we want to come back and look at it a bit more in depth. And before we do, let me just say that Leviticus 27 is, I think, a chapter that still needs more work done on it, not only me personally, but I think theologians in general. There's still a good deal of disagreement about the whole purpose of this chapter. A lot of theologians treat this as something as an appendix to the book. I'm going to argue today that it's not like an appendix. It's not something attached onto the end, but that there's an actual, a rational reason why it comes at the end of Leviticus as it does. And it kind of brings us back to the beginning of Leviticus in the chiastic structure of the book that we've seen. Having said that, there's still much about this chapter that I don't understand. And so without getting into the particulars, though, I think there are a number of things that we can learn from it, and that's what I'll try to do, you know, with those caveats in mind, so to speak. Okay? In particular, what we see is this. You come to Leviticus 27, and it deals with things that are vowed to the Lord. And I will make a distinction later about things that are sanctified to the Lord and things that are devoted to the Lord. There are different words in Hebrew, okay? But in particular, it deals with the redemption of vows, and also with payments that are made in regard to things that are devoted. Okay, now I'll explain what all that means here in just a bit. But what we see, if you read through the chapter, the first section concerns things that have been, people and animals that have been vowed to God. Okay? You could dedicate an animal to give it to the tabernacle. You could dedicate someone to the tabernacle, like, for example, Samuel. You remember Hannah prayed to God that the Lord would give her a child, and she vowed to God to give that child to the Lord if he would grant her that request. And the Lord answered that request, and Samuel was given to the tabernacle to be raised in the priesthood by Eli. Okay, so the first portion has to do with vows regarding people and animals. Then there are, you can dedicate land and houses to the Lord. And then there are various other miscellaneous regulations about other things that might be vowed to the Lord. Okay? So you kind of have the first part has to deal with living things that can be vowed to God, and then inanimate things that might be vowed to God. Now, the question becomes, though, what does all of this have to do with the rest of the book and what we just finished on? In other words, a lot of people think that the blessings and curses of the covenant that we read about in chapter 26 would be a much more fitting way to end the book. God has given Israel his laws, and then he might say, okay, so now here, you keep my laws, these are all the ways you're going to bless, I'll bless you. And if you don't keep my laws, here's all the ways I'm going to curse you. That would seem like a more fitting into the book than all of a sudden this chapter, which seems to be divorced from everything else. But if you think about it, and I'm going to give other reasons why it makes sense to come here, but there's a sense in which the blessings and the curses of the covenant set forth in Leviticus 26 are sort of the things that God vows to do. Okay? If you keep my laws, here's all the ways I'm going to bless you. This is what these are my promises to you. If you don't keep my laws, here's all the ways that I'm going to curse you. These are my promises to you. Okay? And so this may prompt a consideration of the things that humans may vow to do in regard to God. Okay? What we see throughout Scripture is many times, especially when a person is in times of distress, they often will vow to God that if God will deliver them, or as we mentioned with Hannah, provide some answer to prayer, then they will vow to, you know, do something in return for that. Now, the thing is, though, the Bible recognizes that. Before I get ahead of myself, so in short, we got so the logic is kind of God's vows to us, and then our vows to God. Okay, that might explain how this builds on the heels of chapter 26. Okay, but beyond this, you know, vows, because they're made in times of distress, there is oftentimes after that distress is over, sometimes a reluctance to pay that which is vowed. And the Bible recognizes there will be that temptation. And so there are many passages, and I have a number listed there for you, that not only passages where you see people doing like what we've talked about, but there are many warnings about not fulfilling your vows after you have made them. And there are passages which say you're better off not having vowed something than if you refuse then to repay that. Okay? And so part of the purpose of Leviticus 27 seems to discourage making rash vows by setting forth what are basically sort of some steep payment prices for refusing to carry out those vows. At the same time, though, it does provide compassionate ways to fulfill a vow in ways other than you might have specifically vowed. Okay? So in other words, you vow that if the Lord will deliver you, you will you vow that you will give up this piece of property. Okay? You'll give it to the Lord's work, give it to the sanctuary. And then afterwards, you regret doing that. So you might pay an amount which many of these amounts are fairly steep, and would have been hard for many to pay. But you might pay an amount to redeem that which you vowed. Okay. And so what that does is, like I said, it discourages rash vows, but at the same time it does provide, you know, some compassion for a person not to be bound by the full implications of that vow. Okay? So that's what it appears to do. Now, in other things, there are payment prices for things which are devoted, which is different. Okay? If something is devoted, that's permanent. And there's no redemption price for things that are devoted. And we'll explain that in just a minute. Okay. With that in mind, let me point out that if you begin reading this chapter, you'll find that payment is always made in the sanctuary shekel. Okay? That's going to be important for matters we'll see in just a little bit. But what we know is that Israel had a true separation of church and state not in the way we often speak of it, which today separation of church and state is usually means the state is not subject to the lordship of Christ. Well, that was not at all the case in ancient Israel. The state was a minister of God's to enforce his law, and it was separate in what it did, in that it administered the sword and not the keys of the kingdom, etc. It was a separate institution. Well, in ancient Israel, you actually had two different kinds of currency. There was a special currency for the sanctuary. And the valuations that we have here are in that sanctuary coinage called the shekel. And what follows is, if you vow someone who's this age, you pay this much, okay? And then if they're at another age, you know, more advanced, a full-grown man, okay, that person would be valued more. If it was an older person, the valuation would be less. Valuation for males was greater than valuation for females. All right? So it was according to age and according to gender. Now, in our times, you know, this is one of those passages that, you know, people pull out and say, see, there it is. There's this misogynistic old book with, you know, all of its outdated patriarchy and all that sort of stuff. That's a very simplistic reading of this issue, okay? What I mean by that is, if you look at it, the valuations that we have here are similar to what a lot of scholars have shown, similar to what the valuation of that a person might receive on the slave market. Okay? And what it had to do with was physical labor in an agrarian society. Okay? A little child eventually is going to be a help around the farm, but initially there's a lot of expense involved in raising children. An older person can't do the work that a younger person is capable of. Do what? There you go. I'm finding that out more and more. Okay, you can't do what you used to could do. And in the days before machinery, et cetera, when labor, most labor was physical, just the reality is a young man can do more than an older man and so on. And so just, it's like if you go to buy a lawnmower, and one with a 36 inch cutting deck doesn't cost as much as one with a 48 inch cutting deck. You can be more productive with the larger lawnmower than you can the smaller one. So that seems to be what's set forth there. And I want to make that point. My Facebook feed has been filled this week with all sorts of Bible verses on memes about immigration that are simplistic and there you go. You know, be kind to the stranger and the alien and so forth. And some just, you know, if just berating Christians, if there's any, you know, concern about Muslim immigration and so forth. I shared an article this morning that, actually looks into some of what the Bible says about immigration, about borders and permission to enter and the differences between the stranger and the alien. And check that out because, you know, this simplistic reading of scripture today is really kind of sad. And so what's going on with that happens oftentimes with this passage. Okay. The valuations seem to have more to do with a person's ability to do physical labor in agrarian society. Okay. So you dedicate something, someone, here's the payment price to redeem that which is dedicated. All right. When we come to the New Testament, I'm here at Roman numeral 2. I'm going to spend more time talking about things devoted. But There's been, here again, there's been a lot of misunderstanding, and when Jesus warns against swearing, says, let your yes be yes, your no be no, contrary to how that's sometimes taken, Jesus did not imply that there's never a time for the taking of vows. Jesus is warning about carelessly taking vows in the course of everyday life and in regard to things that would be of no significance. Like, for example, you know, somebody says, well, I swear on my dead mother's grave. Well, your dead mama ain't going to do anything if you can't, don't fulfill your vow, okay? In the Bible, a vow is usually calling upon God to enforce the sanctions in the event that I don't fulfill the vow. Okay? So, you know, I put my hand on the Bible and I swear to tell the truth and hold truth and nothing but the truth, so help me God. And what I'm saying is, if I lie, you know, I may get away with it with the court, but I'm asking God to judge me if I so do that. Now, that kind of works if there, you live in a culture where there's actually a fear of God. Not so much today. I mean, you know, I always think about the politicians who get up there and swear to uphold the Constitution. You know, I wouldn't want to stand beside them a lot of times. You know, you have no intention whatsoever of holding the Constitution. You have no idea what it even says, right? But usually we still take oaths then, and it usually has to do with the institutions God has set forth to keep those oaths. When we're baptized, we take oath. When we get married, we take oaths. When we are in a court of law, we take oaths. We do those sorts of things. So Jesus warns about that. He also warns about, you know, as the New Testament does, not fulfilling vows. And we still see people taking vows in the New Testament. Paul, if you remember, on his second missionary journey, he's makes a stop in Ephesus, and they want him to stay. And he says, no, I've made a vow, and I've got to get it to Jerusalem before this feast. So that kind of shows that, you know, vows are not prohibited. So we still see that happening. And so, you know, the New Testament, like the Old Testament, warns about not fulfilling vows and so on. Jesus warned the Pharisees about improper vows when they would dedicate their houses to the temple. They would do this in order to avoid fulfilling the fifth commandment of honoring their father and mother. They would dedicate their possessions to the temple, and but they would continue to use them and dwell in those houses until they die. You see some of these televangelists who, you know, you can fill out a will here and you can leave and support this ministry and all that. You know, hey, if you have no heir and you want to support a ministry, have at it. Ordinarily, inheritance goes to the children, okay? Now, if your children aren't covenant keepers, then you might want to do something like that. But you can see the Pharisees doing this sort of thing. And so then when their parents, who were aged, needed help, they said, well, I'm sorry, I can't help you because this is dedicated to the Lord. Sounds real pious, but it was really a way to skirt the commandment. Okay, and that's what, so Jesus warns about that. Jesus warns about becoming his disciple lightly and turning back. So you see, long story short, you see that the New Testament is consistent with the Old Testament in regard to vows, etc., and the redemption of vows. Okay? Now, that's things devoted to, things vowed to God. Now, I want to turn over to page 2 to deal more with things devoted to God. Let me just stop right there, see if you have any questions or I can't answer or comments. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Didn't the female pay more?
Yeah.
I think I got that wrong. I must have. It doesn't matter how many times I look over these things. It's always the males always are more than the female. I'll have to go back and look at that. How did I do that? Thanks for catching that.
Well, truth be told, at age 60, the women are worth more than the men.
They probably are. They last longer than we do oftentimes, don't they? Right. Maybe that is right. I'm pretty sure that it's the other way around. All right. Well, let's talk about now. We come to Roman number 3, things devoted to God. And this is here's an area now where a number of commentaries don't make a distinction. They don't make a careful distinction about things that are sanctified to God versus things that are devoted to God. There's actually a different word. And the word for devoted to God is a word that's oftentimes used in reference to a city that is under the ban. You know, in ancient Israel, you know, if a city was under the ban, then everything, man, woman, child, livestock, it all had to be killed for holy warfare. Now, other cities, that wasn't the case, okay? Well, we have to recognize that there is a distinction between things that are sanctified or set apart to God and things that are devoted. And I'll just read a little quote here in letter A. A sanctified item was set apart for God's use, though not necessarily on a permanent basis. In other words, that's something you could redeem. A devoted thing was set apart permanently for priestly service or sacrifice. And that devoted item or person could not be redeemed by payment of a price. And we saw that was the case with Jephthah's daughter. Remember, Jephthah says, you know, if the Lord gives me victory, I'm gonna offer whatever, you know, first thing comes out of my house as an ascension offering. That's one of those where whole burnt sacrifice just does not work well. We argue that Jephthah did not perform human sacrifice, which was contrary to the law. What he did was devote his daughter to sanctuary service. Okay? That's why Jephthah is one of the heroes of the faith in Hebrews 11. Okay? He did not perform human sacrifice. Okay?
I always thought that was kind of a strange vow to begin with. I mean, did he ordinarily have sheep coming out of his house?
Well, no. I don't think so. You know? That's the thing. The people didn't keep the livestock in the house, but I think he expected probably one of his servants or something.
Brian said
might have been sick. Yeah. Okay. At the burgers, it would be the goats. Not in the house. All right. Well. Well, let me point out that a lot of times we think only Levites perform tasks in the tabernacle. And Levites could perform, Levites did, you know, administer the sacraments. However, there is plenty of evidence there were other servants who did various menial tasks that needed to be performed at the tabernacle. We know, for example, even the Gentile Gibeonites were hewers of water and cutters of wood, okay? You remember that group of Gentiles, God said they were to destroy all the inhabitants of Canaan. They could not enter into covenant with any of the inhabitants of Canaan. They could, with foreign nations, weren't under the ban like the inhabitants of Canaan was. The Gibeonites dressed themselves up in these old clothes and act as if they are coming from a foreign land, and they enter into covenant with Israel. Come to find out, they live there in the promised land. And so, because you know the Israelites didn't pray, and they kind of made a rash vow, the Gibeonites are allowed to live. But, you know, they're always carrying water. And you remember you got that big laver in the tabernacle. And then, of course, the fire had to always be kept burning. And so they're hewers of wood and, you know, carriers of water. So they're out there cutting the wood and bringing it. So they do menial tasks at the tabernacle. Besides for the Gibeonites, we have evidence that there are women who served at the tabernacle as well. You remember Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were engaging in inappropriate relationships with the women there who served at the tabernacle. Okay? So people could be devoted to the temple. And of course, maybe the most, two of the most famous people who were dedicated to the temple for perpetual service, are Samuel and Jephthah's daughter, though most people don't realize Jephthah's daughter, that's what the situation is. Okay? But if we look at this, where's it? 1 Samuel 1, Hannah is barren, and she vows to God if the Lord will, you know, hear her, then she's gonna dedicate him as a lifelong Nazarite. And I'm just, 1 Samuel 1:11 says, "Then she made a vow and said, 'O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head.'" Okay? Now he's going to be given to priestly service, and he's going to be a lifelong Nazarite. Okay? Now keep that in mind. Okay? Here's a person who's devoted to the Lord for their whole life. This isn't a temporary person that can be bought back. All right? In regard to persons or things devoted, where there is no redemption price, there is nevertheless a required payment that accompanies that person. Okay? The thing we need to point out is that in Leviticus 27, when it speaks of devoting someone to God, the word that is used there is only used in regard to vows one other time, and that's in regard to the Nazarite vow in number 6. Okay? Now, a Nazarite is kind of like a priest extraordinaire. In the Old Testament, there are 3 lifelong Nazarites. Okay? There is Samuel, Samson, and I shouldn't say Old Testament, but Old Covenant, John the Baptist. Okay? John the Baptist is still, you know, part of the Old Covenant. All right? So there are 3 men who are dedicated to be lifelong Nazarites in Scripture. Okay? And just keep in mind that these 3 men, their mothers were all barren. So God has to miraculously open their wombs in order for them to give birth to those lifelong Nazarites. And we talked about this a long time ago before, that in the Old Testament, there are 6 women altogether who are barren. The 3 wives of the patriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel, who are to give birth to, you know, prior to the promised seed line, those 3 women are barren. God has to miraculously give them children. And then you have the mothers of the lifelong Nazarites who were barren, where God had to miraculously give them children. The wife of Manoah, the mother of Samuel, Hannah, and then Elizabeth. Okay? And all of that is typological and is pointing forward to the birth of Christ, who comes from the ultimate barren womb, the womb of the virgin. Interestingly, Hannah, when she praises God for giving, when Eli comes and says, "God's going to remember your vow," she responds in prayer, in a prayer that kind of definitely influenced Mary's Magnificat. And she says, the barren has borne seven. Well, I think little did she know that's prophetic. So altogether, you come to the ultimate barren womb, the womb of the virgin, who gives birth to the promised seed, who is Jesus of Nazareth. Okay? Now, what's interesting about that is Matthew tells us, and you know, Matthew likes to quote the Old Testament all the time in regard to Jesus to show how he fulfills it. And one of the things that after Jesus is taken, you know, Jesus is taken to Egypt as a baby, and Matthew says, this was fulfilled so that it would be said, out of Egypt I call my son. But then after Herod dies and they take Jesus back to Nazareth to grow up, Matthew says, and this was done so that it be fulfilled, he shall be called a Nazarene. Well, where in the Old Testament do you find it's saying Jesus is going to be a Nazarene? Well, I think the implication is symbolically the people understanding what a Nazarite was concluded that the Messiah must be a Nazarite. Not necessarily a lifelong Nazarite, but at least a temporary Nazarite. Okay, and what I mean by that is, it appears that every ancient Israelite, whenever they went into holy war, they would take a temporary Nazarite vow. Okay? We know in the Song of Deborah after the victory over Sisera, they're celebrating the victory, and in Judges 5:2 it says, that long locks of hair hung loose in Israel, that the people volunteered, praise Yahweh. Okay? When a man was going to battle, he would take a temporary Nazarite vow. He would abstain from the fruit of the vine. He would let his hair grow long until after the victory. Then he would come, you know, and cut his hair, and then he would celebrate his victory and so on. That's why we see, for example, when David summons Uriah in from battle and tries to get him to go into his wife Bathsheba. He refuses to do so. David wants to get him drunk. And Uriah refuses those things because it appears he remained under the Nazarite vow. And he says, I can't, while the men of Israel are in the tents, I can't do this thing. Okay? Now, what's important to point out is that when a man took this Nazarite vow, he also made a payment, okay? And the priest could always value. If somebody didn't have money, they could devalue some of these things. But he had to make a payment every time the they were mustered for battle. They had to pay a half shekel ransom for their soul. And the reasoning seems to be this: God dwelt in Israel's war camp. Remember, God says, I will go before you into battle. And so the Levites would take the Ark of the Covenant. You know, that one time they got captured in battle because the Lord wasn't on their side against the Philistines. Well, because the Lord dwelt in the midst of Israel, the war camp became holy. Okay? And so, for example, in Deuteronomy 23, if you were ceremonially unclean, you had to go out of the war camp. Now, ordinarily in daily life, if you became ceremonially unclean, that only meant you could not go to the tabernacle. You could go to work. You could go out in the community. You could do all those sorts of things being ceremonially unclean. Ordinary uncleanness, you didn't become unclean just by touching that person. More severe form than uncleanness spread. But when you drew near to God, you could not be ceremonially unclean. And so a person in the war camp who became unclean had to go outside the camp. And there's even provision in Deuteronomy 23. If you go to the bathroom, you have to do it outside the camp. And then you have to take a shovel and cover it up because the Lord walks in your war camp. Okay, look that up in Deuteronomy 23. God doesn't want to step in it. Okay? All right. So the idea is God is in the midst of Israel in the war camp. And so everybody is going up, okay, to the sanctuary, so to speak. And so they have to bring with them a half shekel. Because whenever you draw near to God, God says, do not appear before me empty-handed. Okay? That's why, you know, every week we offer up our sacrifice of praise, etc., in our worship service. You don't come here and just not participate. All right? Some people have, I don't know if I want to get into that, you know, should we, it's hard if you're paid once a month and stuff, you know, should you tithe every week, you know, divide your tithe up so that you never appear before the Lord empty handed. I don't know, how that works. I've taken that kind of be a sacrifice of praise. But to my point, if you recall, the very first chapter of Leviticus concerned the ascension offering, what is mistakenly referred to as the whole burnt offering, but what in reality was the ascension offering. The animal was ascending into God's presence, okay? And what came on top of that always was the tribute offering, the grain offering, we call it, in chapter 2. So if you're going up to the Lord, you're ascending into the Lord's presence, you must always bring tribute. Okay? And so God says, you don't appear before me empty-handed. And so what that means then is, now if I'm going into the war camp, I'm going up, I have to pay tribute. Okay? I have to pay tribute in the form of the shekel of the sanctuary shekel. Okay? Because the war camp is holy because it's like the tabernacle or temple because the Lord is going with Israel. Alright, now, last page here. This is where this kind of becomes kind of cool. What you see already in the chiastic structure, suddenly Leviticus 27 makes sense. Leviticus 1 is about ascending into God's presence through the animal sacrifice. Leviticus 27 is about ascending, the person being devoted, going to the holy hill of the Lord, okay, with tribute. Alright, so we come full circle in the chiastic structure of the book. Pointing forward to Jesus, the question becomes, Jesus doesn't appear, he's from Nazareth, but he never appears to take the Nazarite vow. In fact, Jesus is, you know, John the Baptist, he doesn't ever drink of the fruit of the vine. But Jesus has a reputation for partying. They accuse him of being a glutton and a drunkard. In fact, you know, he's everywhere he goes, there's a party. And Jesus contrasts John's ministry with his own. You know, they reject both. Well, the question becomes then, when does Jesus take the Nazarite vow? And I know we've talked about this before. But if you remember, the night in which he's betrayed, he's instituting the Lord's Supper. He knows he's going to do battle with Satan the next day. And he says, I'll no longer drink of the fruit of the vine until I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom. Okay? Now, here's how most commentaries take it. Most commentaries say, well, see, Jesus, you know, here's our utilitarian 21st century mindset. Jesus wants to have his wits about him as he goes before the cross because he still has things to accomplish. Okay? It's just like William Wallace in Braveheart. You know, his love interest comes to, at least he won't watch Braveheart with me, you know? She just hates that movie. It's too violent. And, of course, you know, every man dies. Not every man really lives, you know. Yeah, you quote it. But his love interest comes to him there in the end. And she tries to get him to take this stuff to deaden the pain. She knows they're going to torture him the next day. And of course, he refuses. You know, he spits it out because he doesn't. He has to keep his wits about him, you know, to withstand the torture. That's how commentators take that. Okay, that's why Jesus refuses it. No, I don't think so. I think in light of everything we see, Jesus knows he's going to do battle. Okay? Jesus is going to the place of the skull. The prophecy is that the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent. So Jesus is going to Golgotha, to the place of the skull, to disarm principalities and powers, to crush the head of the serpent. And so he takes the Nazarite vow on him, you know, himself before going to the cross. Which interestingly, when he's offered wine, with gall before his crucifixion, he refuses it. And it's only when all things had already been accomplished that Jesus accepts to drink the drink of sour wine. Okay? When he's completed his labors, then he partakes of the vine. I think that's, you know, that's proof. Jesus triumphed on the cross. Okay? And that's why he drinks it anew with us in Father's kingdom every week. Okay? He's faithful to the Nazarite vow until he's victorious. Okay? That's when he accepts the wine and gives up the ghost. Now, what's kind of neat about all of this is it appears that while Jesus is on the Nazarite vow, payment is made for him, ironically, by Judas. And what we mean by that is, if you recall, Judas is paid 30 shekels. Remember, that's the specific coinage that has to be used in Leviticus 27. That's the coinage of the sanctuary. Judas was paid 30 shekels of silver in order to betray Jesus. We know from a couple of passages there, Exodus 21, Zechariah 11, that 30 pieces of silver was the ordinary price of a slave in the ancient world. Remember, the priest could set valuations. So they don't perceive Jesus to be like a free man as a Galilean peasant. But they set a price for Jesus. Judas agrees to it. Then Jesus is crucified, and Judas returns the money to the sanctuary. Okay? And in terms of the payment that you would generally make for the dedication of a person. In this case, it would not be a freedman, which would be 50 shekels. But it appears that the Nazarite vow is paid for Jesus while he's under that vow. And, you know, to me, I mean, I'm sure there's more to this, but so often when we're told all these little details in the text, we just read right over them. Like I said, the commentaries a lot of times will just, you know, they'll note that is the price of a slave. Most everyone will. Without also considering maybe the other symbolic dimensions to it. Whenever scripture tells us about things, it gives us detail. The Holy Spirit isn't just, you know, telling this to make the story interesting like a good descriptive author. Okay? The Holy Spirit, when it says Jesus wore a crown of thorns, is hearkening back to the thorns and thistles that are coming up out of the ground because of man's fall. It's not a coincidence that Jesus is naked on the cross, okay? Just as Adam and Eve were naked and not ashamed until God came into the garden and then they tried to cover themselves. Jesus is exposed to the thorns, to the curse, to the shame of it. He sweats like great drops of blood because Adam's going to till the ground, you know, by the sweat of his brow. Every one of those details, I think. I mean, I think they're there for a reason. And we're to tie all this stuff into Jesus. The Bible could have just said that they gave him a bag of coins to betray Jesus and he returned it. But it tells us 30 shekels of silver. And I think we're supposed to make that connection. We're supposed to see that. Okay? So that's what I think is going on here in this text. That's the best I can do with Leviticus 27. And I hope some of that makes some sense. Yes, sir.
The last thing puzzles me a bit. It says the Nazarite dedication money was paid by Judas. Mm-hmm. Now, during the time in which Jesus was under the Nazarite vow, but a couple sentences prior to that, you say, Judas returned the money given to him to the sanctuary. So, Judas did not return the money, did he, until after Christ died?
Had he died or was he on the cross? No, it's during this time. 27:5, then he threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. And so Jesus had been betrayed by that time, and he doesn't die until verse 50.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then it was during the time.
During the time of the Nazirite vow. He had taken the vow during the Last Supper. He's arrested the high priest's house, and then on to Pilate, and payments made. Yes, sir.
Going back, I really like all of it is, and it seems like everything makes a lot of sense, especially with Jesus claiming victory prior to the drinking of the vine again. But I read this passage in Romans 16, which is really confusing to me. I don't understand my job, but basically Romans 16, 20 says that obviously Paul's speaking to the Romans, and he says that the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet. And how does that comport? I mean, it's the difference between Christ, who is our head, and versus us, and some sort of working out of the victory that Christ already made, or something like that.
I have to go back and look, but the way it's often described, many people liken to Jesus' death on the cross being something like D-Day. The Allied forces knew if they won on D-Day and they could develop a beachfront, a landing zone on that day, that it was only a matter of time before the victory in Europe would be completed. And so the decisive victory was won then, so it was only, you know, within the next year, over the course of the next year, then the Allied forces continued to push back, you know, the Axis forces until they were destroyed. And so I kind of think, you know, Jesus conquered Satan. He disarmed principalities and powers, made a spectacle of them openly, as Paul says in Colossians 2. But then I think we then, following his footsteps as part of his body, then continue that as we go forth, you know, conquering the world and fulfillment of the Great Commission. That's how I kind of take that. So, like, the decisive victory was made. That enables then us to expand that victory. That's how I kind of take it. So
it's kind of like the powers and the forces representative of or previously represented by Satan, or his derivative, you know, residual power
and influence.
Not Satan, yeah. Discreetly.
It's always, you know, there's one of those things where you know, my father may say, you know, he fought Hitler. Did he fight him hand to hand? No, he fought Hitler's forces. So that's sort of the best that I think I can say of that. There's a lot of debate about the present status of Satan. Revelation 20 teaches he's bound that he may no longer deceive the nation. So that's why the gospel can go forth now to the world rather than the nations all coming here. Now we go and make disciples of the nation. And so now Christianity can spread throughout the world. But, you know, we still see, you know, influence of Satan in the world today. So, you know, to what degree is he bound? Is he bound on a long chain? Is it a matter of what we see today mostly is simply the result of sinful human beings? And, you know, I've said in the past, I don't think most of us ever encounter Satan personally in our temptation. Satan is not omnipresent. I think once he got that ball rolling, I do a pretty good job of sitting without even him, you know, with his temptation. So, if that makes any sense. The degree of Satan's influence. But you think about the depravity of the human heart, you know, deceitful above all things, desperate, wicked. So there is the world and its influence, and Satan's followers, and there's a lot of evil in the world. You know, how much of it is simply the residual evil?
kind of stress it, that, you know, we're not, it's clearly saying he's not omnipresent. And if we have to expect where he might be, we would think probably in some of the positions of power he can do the most damage. We see in his temptation of David, that led to David's sin and mustered the army in a time of peace, contrary to the law. That led to consequences for the whole nation. All the more reason why to pray for our leaders and so on. You know, if I'm Satan, I got bigger fish to fry than Bobby Bailey, you know. He's probably in D.C. and Beijing and Moscow. Seth, we need to chant something.
Yeah,
we can come. Wow, we get
it. Real fast as he comes up. Correct. He vowed to offer her up as an ascension. Unfortunately, which means to go up. I think she went to the sanctuary. She served there as a perpetual virgin, and he lamented the fact that he did not have then a dynasty, a family. I can give you some stuff on that. I note Jephthah is in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11, and I don't think he would have made it if he performed human sacrifice.